Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. San Juan Regional Medical Center is your community hospital, committed to making life better for the communities we are privileged to serve. In fact, better is our mission, improving lives through personalized health and care. What matters most to our patients matters most to us. Offering a comprehensive range of inpatient, outpatient, and emergency care services so you can get the quality care you need right here at home. San Juan Regional Medical Center, celebrating life better here since 1910. Ten minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, the fifth day of January in the new year 2023. Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Micklin. Thanks for joining me this morning. We are streaming this program live, of course, on KSJE.com. We're also streaming the video out to the KSJE Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and our Twitter account. So we are glad that you are with us this morning at 90.9 FM here in Farmington or 103.3 FM in Durango. Coming up this morning, in the next few moments, my guest on the program, archaeologist Paul Reed, is joining me for our regular discussion with some new news about some newly discovered settlements in North America. And we'll talk about the significance of that coming up with my guest in just a moment here on KSJE. Then later on this morning, we'll be checking in with Misto the Magi, the big magic show that he is bringing to San Juan College next week. We will learn all about that coming up today, some tricks, and you'll see some tricks actually too on our interview. That's coming up today, 8:50 a.m. this morning here on KSJE and on our video live streams as well. Mick Hess will be here on the radio next hour, of course, roving with the arts. It is our long-standing classical music program featuring music today from Mozart. And don't forget, you can connect with us on our Instagram page in addition to our Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter platforms. And if you're a podcast person, we remind you that you can subscribe to KSJE Podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts, places like iTunes and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Google Podcasts and Pandora. Just search for KSJE and sign up for free. Outside our studios here at San Juan College, it's a mostly cloudy Thursday morning so far, 24 degrees at the moment. We're expecting some increasing sunshine today, but still a partly sunny day, 42 for a high by this afternoon in Farmington. Partly cloudy overnight, 31 for a low tomorrow. Partly sunny skies with a high near 40 degrees on Friday. Same story on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Look at that, partly sunny skies, 37 for a high on Saturday, 40 degrees on Sunday, 39 on Monday. Maybe the next chance of precipitation will happen Tuesday night into Wednesday with a chance of rain and snow showers on that 24-hour period. Well, let me introduce my guest who is joining me this morning. As I mentioned, my regular guest who's with us to talk about archaeology, Paul Reed, is joining us this morning from his home in the Taos area. And Paul, good morning. Always great to see you. Happy New Year.
Good morning, Scott. Great to see you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very, very much. And you had sent me this article about this discovery kind of in the Idaho area, if I remember correctly, and kind of the significance of it, kind of pushing back some of the timelines that we are familiar with about the populations here in North America, correct?
Right. So this is, along with, of course, my fascination with Chaco Canyon.
Sure.
This is probably in my second or third group for the most interesting things that I like to keep up on in archaeology. And I don't work very frequently on sites of this age, but this is a period that we describe as Paleo-Indian, the most ancient sites in North America or in the New World. And yeah, this site at Cooper's Ferry in sort of central Idaho on the Snake River has really good evidence of early human use, and pushing it back perhaps a couple thousand years before, you know, what we talk about is the large sort of widespread Clovis horizon.
Interesting.
So I think this is another site that sort of adds a piece in this puzzle as we try to understand the early settlements of North America.
Right. And I want to give credit to Science Advances. That is the publication that you shared with me. And they have published some of this research, I think, along with some of the images we'll be sharing on the show this morning, that talks a little bit about the discovery and the work at this particular site, correct? And some of the evidence that they have uncovered?
Right, right. And you know, as with all branches of science, you know, new discoveries tend to push sort of the margins of what we think and, you know, whatever scientific community we're operating in, what we think we know about different parts in this sense of, you know, the ancient history of North America. This is particularly controversial, though, because sites that sort of push what we might call the Clovis boundary have, you know, been known in the archaeological literature and sort of the public realm for several decades now. But there is still, I would say, from what I would think for me is a fairly neutral stance on this, there's a lot of resistance from some archaeologists to be able to embrace the idea that Clovis is not the first presence of humans in the New World and North America in particular. And I think with more and more sites coming up that we're seeing, that, you know, the Clovis firsters, as we sometimes jokingly call folks, probably need to just, you know, adapt to this and see that we do have these very interesting early sites.
Right. And does this fall into the, I guess, previously, understood idea of these migrations across, like, the land bridge, as you and I have talked about before, right? And the migration maybe down the Pacific coast and things along that line, and this site in kind of more inland in the Idaho area. Does that kind of follow in with what we already think we know about these movements of people, or is this something really brand new?
I think it's kind of in the middle. So, you know, let's say 30 years ago, 35 years ago-ish, when I was coming up and learning things, the big thing was we had this ice-free corridor that existed up in, you know, up through Canada and up into Alaska. And that was with the retreat of glaciers. And we're talking sort of in the, 15,000 years ago range, that the ice, you know, melted and retreated enough and folks were able to come through at some point a little bit inland off the coast. And that then they made their way down through Canada, Central Canada, into North America, and then helped create this sort of widespread Clovis, you know, group, culture, horizon. You know, my view is Clovis, it was not like a single unified culture like we might talk about different ethnic or social groups today, but a group of people practicing very similar adaptations. They're hunting large animals, you know, big mammoths, mastodons, sloths, giant ancient bison, et cetera. So this was a widespread horizon, and this was thought to have happened during the time it did. And this is Clovis, so about 11,500-ish, you know, BCE, across North America because of the ice-free corridor. So this site, with what the archaeologists, the investigators think is pretty solid dating 2,000 years before that. So we're talking, in the range of 14,000 BCE to potentially a little earlier, this would have had to have happened probably through a coastal migration route, because at 14,000 BCE or 16,000 years ago, it's thought that that ice-free corridor hadn't yet developed. And that's part of why I think we've been sort of stuck in North American archaeology with this idea of Clovis being first, is, you know, archaeologists have felt like the ice had to have broken up sufficiently to let people come south. But the coastal route sort of hypothesis, if we want to talk about that, is, I think, a very viable option for groups making their way down coastal areas where the ice was a lot less thick. And, you know, the thought is that folks would have had access to some land areas as they came south. The other interesting finding through, you know, about the last decade of work is that we have hunters and gatherers in the area of Beringia, you know, this so-called land bridge, which is really a very large area of land with a lot of water tied up in the ice, that folks were up there for several thousand years before, you know, whatever resources kind of helped them come down to the east and to the south. So I think that's it's a shifting picture over these decades of how humans came to colonize North America. And I think the site fits in with that, you know, pretty well.
Sure. Let me show a picture from the article a little bit, too, about, I think, just what you described, right? Is this maybe inland route from the coast along the Columbia River as this ice sheet maybe retreats a little bit and makes some of this land a little more habitable, if you don't mind me saying, and this site is located along the Salmon River in Idaho?
Right, exactly. And, you know, the thought is that folks were adapted to a variety of different resources. If they were doing coastal type, you know, resource procurement, then they're doing fish and shellfish and a variety of resources. And this is not necessarily the more big game dominant adaptation we see later during Clovis of the very large animals, the megafauna, as we call them. So it's thought to be a more varied adaptation with hunting and fishing and gathering of plants, of course, in there.
Right. Understood. And Paul Reed, tell me a little bit about, I guess, you know, when you're looking at a piece of land like this, how would archaeologists or others realize where to look? Is this, again, something maybe through some of the newer technology that they're able to do with some maybe ground-penetrating radar or things like that to see things that are deep? Because I would assume a site this old isn't really at the surface anymore. It's fairly well underground by this time.
Right. This one was buried pretty substantially. And in this case, what drives different ones of these projects is development. So, you know, as we've talked at different points on the show, you know, when development happens in the U.S. and involves federal land or federal dollars, then cultural resource investigations are required. So in this case, the company was investigating the site and then got researchers involved and also involved the Nez Perce tribe, which is great, involving, I think, pretty close tribal cooperation and collaboration on this. So essentially, there was a window into investigating the site. And most of the times, unless folks have super well-funded research projects, you know, these things come in the form of different discoveries. And then resources are brought to bear, proposals are written, and then groups are able to investigate sites over time. And that's what's going on here. And it is, you know, I guess somewhat fortuitous if we want to talk about it that way. The site came to attention, was protected from development as well as natural forces of erosion, and was able to be investigated.
Right. And I'm displaying another image, another graphic on the screen right now, Paul. It seems to show maybe several sites maybe built on top of each other over the years. Does that make sense? Is that what I'm looking at?
Right. This particular locale has a pretty good time depth of occupation, I think at least on the scale of 5,000 to 6,000 years. And this kind of goes to some of the controversy that we see about these early sites, and this one in particular, because there are well-dated earlier deposits with stone tools, projectile points, spear points, which fit in with what we would describe as Clovis or Clovis era. And then there's this earlier deposit with slightly different stemmed projectile points is how they're described. The skeptics, if you will, for this particular site would say, oh, well, there's been mixing between these horizontal layers in this particular site and material that actually is older than the cultural remains that we're talking about, the spear points, the other stone tools, some of the bone that was worked has come up from lower depths and up through the strata. And this can happen through natural processes. It can happen through different rodents, you know, getting into sites. You know, one of the scourges of archaeological work are rodents who get in and burrow in sites because, you know, sites are organic rich, there's charcoal, there's other remains, and they're basically just a lot easier for the rodents to get into and dig into and to build homes. So the material migrates upward, and then you end up with organic material. You know, it could be wood charcoal or other plants that have been burned partially that can be then radiocarbon dated. And they have a lot of dates from this site, I should point out. But the criticism is that perhaps those materials were brought upward, you know, from older deposits into younger ones and then associated with the cultural materials there. So one of the big emphasis in the work that we do in archaeology, especially for these early sites, is the association of the artifacts, you know, the items that clearly indicate human activity human concerns, either hunting, gathering things, different tools, stone and bone, and then the organic materials that we can date through the radiocarbon method. So that association, in context, is really critical here.
Interesting. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, is joining me today. We're talking a bit more about some of the earliest human habitation of North America, a new site that's being researched in the central Idaho area that we are talking about this morning. And I guess, Paul, would this also indicate that the people that lived here and hunted here stayed there for generations instead of moving around? Or is it just different groups moving in and maybe saw the same attributes that the first group did, that this was near water and provided some good resources for them to just sit and set a spell?
Right. I mean, it's a great question. And I think I would suggest that it's probably a group that had used this area over this long period of hundreds and thousands of years. Now, we tend, when we think about the way land use has unfolded in different areas, to not think that humans were particularly sedentary until much more recently, in our history. And of course, the planet, prior to people beginning to settle into cities, 10,000, 12,000 years ago, people worldwide, planet-wide, were gatherers and hunters and fisher people, and they were making their living in camps, and then they would move to resources. Sometimes they would move the resources to more extended camps. But in general, people weren't thought to have lived in the same place forever and ever and ever. But, that notion of long-term sedentism can be contrasted with the idea of returning to the same place, if not every year, then on a cycle of a few years, to, go back and on the Salmon River, maybe, it's named for the salmon, to exploit the run of salmon that happens every year, so that the groups would map onto the resources that were in these different areas. And they would be there for a time. Let's say they're harvesting salmon. They're there for a couple of months. And then they move on to a camp for the winter that's maybe at lower elevation, where maybe they can exploit a few remaining plant resources, sort of hunker down for the winter, if you will. In the spring, then they're coming back out and they're looking for spring resources. And then in the summer, going back up to high elevations for berries, nuts, et cetera. So it's essentially a food resource dependent cycle of moving through different areas. So I don't know if that answers the question well. Of course, we don't know if this was a specific durable group of, say, a series of extended families, lineages, what we might call clans or other terms that we use for later groups. My sense is that groups had an idea of what territory was, and that groups certainly shared those. But I think, for particularly resource plentiful areas, the groups probably staked out, some sense of claim and let others know this is where we're going primarily. And I think probably conflicts did arise here and there.
Sure.
So we wouldn't think of this as being a permanent settlement for 5 or 6,000 years, but a very desirable locale that folks came back to over and over, because it was a great place to spend time and to, again, in this case, maybe harvest the salmon.
Right. And I guess that would explain maybe why these other remains were found on top of other remains, because it was a popular or well-known or shared geographical location, I guess, among these folks.
Right, a very favorite spot. And, we know this just being out on the landscape anywhere in our neck of the woods. Some places have better water. They might have better timber and wood resources for fires, versus other areas that don't quite have the same resources. So there are definitely, as we look across North America, what I would describe as favored locales for settlement that have endured in many cases for millennia, literally thousands of years.
Right, right. Very true. I want to move on to another image here. This looks like it's a more detailed graphic of one of the strata that we saw on the previous graphic of kind of what has been discovered, and some of the red dots on the image here show some of the radiocarbon sampling that was taken as I look at this. And this is just an example, I guess, of the work that you all do, archaeologists, when you're looking at a site, correct, to try to identify and put some context into what you're finding underground here?
Right, exactly. And as I noted earlier, I think the investigators have done a really good job of sampling the different strata for different organic materials that could then produce radiocarbon dates. And then, as the work was done, archaeologists paid great attention to the way the dirt, the strata, the sediments have been laid down, paying attention to the idea of, like I said earlier, rodent intrusions or other things that might indicate that they don't have, a really good sequence of consistent sediment being laid down, because that continuity is very important for understanding what's happening on a site like this. And then again, the question of whether materials had moved, older materials had moved upward and might have influenced dating. In this case, and of course I haven't really dug in, to the site at great depth, but it seems like, they've made a really good case for a site that is in this range of 14,000 BCE years ago, or 16,000 years ago, 14,000 BCE. So, a pretty important site in this overall sequence. And I think that, again, as more and more of these sites come up, that we'll begin to understand this time period better. One of the things that works against us, I believe, is that if we look at what happens during the Clovis era, which again is after about 11,500 or so BCE, so 13,000 years ago, we suddenly find Clovis sites. They have been found across a large part of Western North America, some down even to the South in Central and South America. So if we're going to talk about how that came about, we have to understand what happened before it. And we know that hunters and gatherers can move great distances, many, many miles or kilometers over the course of a day, and certainly over the course of a year, as they're going and looking for different resources, plant resources, animal resources, maritime, shellfish and fish resources. So people can move fairly rapidly. But what is has always been very interesting to me about Clovis is, this is talked about as sort of an explosion, or this amazing fluorescence of people all over the continent, in what seems to be archaeologically a very short period of time. So, as I think about different models for this, and the sites that do fall in, seem to fall into this pre-Clovis period, it makes sense to me that there are groups of people coming before that who are starting to understand the resources. And that then perhaps, the word gets back to other groups and they're like, hey, there's a lot of territory here, there's a lot of resources. And, in the sense of the colonization of North America, there weren't other humans there before these groups started to come across. So they would have found an area without a lot of competition from other human groups trying to make their living. So, and I think that ultimately does explain sort of the massive Clovis expansion across North America. But we have to have people before that, in my view, to sort of set it up, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, I think it does. And I think, folks aren't saying that they just beamed in from somewhere, right? They had to come from somewhere, right? Isn't that the idea? And so.
Well, the interesting thing is some of the so-called Clovis firsters, you do wonder
Oh, okay.
because, and ideas ebb
Sure.
and flow as we've talked. And scientists, archaeologists, researchers, ideally work objectively. They don't get too tied to their theories and their hypotheses. But as we've talked a little on the show, Scott, the reality of personalities and funding, and perhaps fame for people who've made careers studying Clovis sites, for example, all those factors come into play. And a lot of times it does take younger researchers who aren't wedded to some of the older ideas to introduce these radical newfangled ideas, if we want to talk about it that way, and sort of shake things up and say, this looks a little different than sort of what's been handed down with archaeological wisdom for 30 or 40 years. So yeah, I think we're in a very interesting time to see some of that transition.
Sure. Well, and isn't part of the science of archaeology, if you will, part of, publishing what you find and your theories and then just opening it up to say, okay, bring it. If you have another idea, let's hear it. But this is what we found. This is our
Right.
evidence to back it up. Here's our documentation, as we've seen in some of these drawings. And then others can look at it and try to pick it apart and come up with their own theory.
That's the way it works, and that's the way it's supposed to work, in my view. So, It is interesting though, because sometimes some of the criticism stems not necessarily from the data at a particular site, but more from the viewpoint that, the reviewer, the critic, if you will, is bringing to it. So, but I think that's why having, the articles get published and then there's discussion at large at meetings. You've talked before about Society for American Archaeology, which is a national organization with, 10,000 archaeologists. Meetings held every year, great debate in public over some of these sites, and that's really how we move things forward. But there will always be folks who hold out and say, no, this I'm still not convinced by the evidence. My sense, and without a scientific poll certainly, but sort of a straw poll among different folks who I work with, in the Southwest primarily, is that most archaeologists have come to an understanding that, pre-Clovis sites do exist, and that, these merit a whole lot more investigation. As I noted, that the count of these sites that have been brought up, I don't have an exact count for you, but it's in the low dozens, and that contrasts with hundreds, certainly of Clovis sites and later sites. So the numbers are extremely small still, but pretty compelling in my mind. And I think we'll continue to see some really interesting research on this. One of the things, and we talked previously about, the footprints down at White Sands and some of the dating down there, which indicated, at least for what they had done, that those prints might have been laid down between 21,000 and about 23,000 years ago. There has been some interesting critique that we might revisit on another show. In the intervening months, Scott, and some questions about the context of what was dated there and whether it actually connects directly to those footprints. The interesting thing about that era at 20,000 years ago is we have virtually no sites at all. So we would have had thousands and thousands of years, of a gap, and then people, again, coming into the area. So there's a whole lot of pieces to the puzzle, is part of what I'm trying to suggest. And a lot of interesting research to that's ongoing and will continue.
Very much. Well, and we just have a few minutes remaining this morning, Paul Reed, but I wanted to bring it back to home here about, that the same types of techniques, right, is how we have come to understand even the sites in our area, right? The Salmon ruins and Chaco Canyon, Aztec ruins, and all these different sites, Mesa Verde. All this is developed over history, right? From the work of all these archaeologists and folks who've put together their research and looked at it, and this is how we get our knowledge today as to what we think these sites were all about, correct?
Right. I mean, from my perspective, history, archaeology, science, has to be an accumulative process. So, I, for my part in the work that I've, some of the work that I've done in my career, I've tried to bring new ideas and think about things differently. But to be able to do that and to innovate, if that's what's happening, or to suggest alternative ideas, one really has to understand how we got from A to B to C. And now we're out here on E, F, and G. So it has to be that accumulative process with a whole lot of thought at different points. And then you reach sort of these decision points, and one researcher might go left and the other goes right. Those are the very interesting choices that people make. But to me, that the diversity of opinion and really approach and even theoretical models, we bring models in to archaeology from anthropology, from history, from geography, from sociology, from other cultural work. So, there's a whole lot of different things that come together, and then folks investigate, they apply data, and they say, hey, this is what I think may have happened in this specific case. And maybe 90% of the people reading it disagree, So you put that one aside, or maybe you keep plugging away at it and you see what happens through time. But
Right.
that is, for me, I think what makes it compellingly interesting, because we don't finish the story. It is an ongoing story, and it is subject to new interpretations, new data, new theories. And none of us were there. So that's, until the physicists presumably invent a time machine that actually allows us to go back and do some observation, we do what we can, but none of us can definitively say this is what happened at this site 15,000 years ago. We tell, hopefully, a very well-informed story, but it still is a narrative, only a narrative of the past, and it's subject to debate.
Right. Well, and it's evolving, I think, too, right? As you've mentioned time and time again. And so things that we thought we knew 30 years ago, maybe aren't so set in stone anymore as we discover new things and new theories come to light. And I would assume when someone puts out something that maybe just doesn't seem right or doesn't make sense, it doesn't last very long in the scientific world, right? There's holes poked through it and we evolve and learn more about it, right?
There can be, what we might describe so-called half-baked ideas that don't stand up to some scrutiny. But I think most of the people who are serious about, these pursuits want to propose ideas that are taken seriously in that marketplace, if you will, of ideas. And, we all have to interact in this environment. We're all very social creatures, so we need input from our colleagues, and that helps us eventually tell a better story, which I think is in some ways the best that we can hope for.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time as always, Paul Reed, this morning. We are out of time, though, but thank you for bringing this article and this site to our attention. And, again, it kind of fills in maybe a little bit more of what we think we know about our continent and the habitation of it. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Scott. My pleasure as always to be on with you.
Appreciate it, Paul. We'll talk to you again in about a month.
Sounds great.
All right, thank you. That is Paul Reed. He works, of course, with Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins, my guest this morning here on KSJE. KSJE is supported by the Farmington Civic Center, bringing a full slate of entertainment to Farmington and San Juan County. Our Planet live in concert, Saturday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. The Farmington Civic Center, 200 West Arrington in downtown Farmington. Find out more online at fmtn.org/shows or 505-599-1148. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.